This is Bill McClure for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Take My Arm.
This is Richard Dunnigan. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is developed with the assistance of print and visually impaired volunteers.
And this is Bob Martin. And I know that we had Craig Brown, the former judge from Durham County, on a while ago, and
I know. He is from Durham County, and we talked with him in length.
And I'm glad he's coming back, because I forgot to ask him a question.
And he has lots of ties to the Triangle area.
He does indeed. Although he was born in Iowa, he received his bachelor's degree in political science from UNC Chapel Hill.
Now, what I need to know is...
And then he also went to law school at UNC and received a master's degree from the School of Public Policy at Duke.
Then he should be able to answer my question.
After law school, he passed the bar and went to work with a law firm in Durham, where he practiced law for 13 years.
It's a question that has been bothering me for some time now.
And in 1995, he was named the North Carolina Lawyer of the Year by the State Bar Association.
It might seem like a simple question, but it has great legal ramifications.
Then, after beginning to lose his eyesight, he was appointed to the bench,
where he served as a district court judge in the 14th Judicial District for 12 years, even though he was blind.
It would take a judicious mind to answer this question.
While serving in the court, he helped establish TROSA, the Triangle Residential Options for Substance Abusers. The organization has a completion rate of 40% after 2 years of involvement.
I bet some of them might have needed the answer to my question.
He was the first judge in Durham County to receive drug treatment court training at the National Judicial College in Reno, Nevada.
And then, working with others, he helped lead the fight to establish a drug treatment court in Durham in 1998.
And then he helped establish the Durham County Criminal Justice Resource Center, which serves more than 2,000 people every year, offering substance abuse training, education, and job training.
I know he'd know the answer.
Since 2003, he has worked with the Durham Public Schools to develop a truancy court policy.
Well, I'm sure truants would have been interested in my question.
And now he is the executive director of the North Carolina Institute on Blindness.
I wonder if blind people would be interested.
And he has written two books about his life experiences. One was entitled Blind Justice, and the other was entitled A Fork in the Road.
You know, that sounds familiar.
It ought to sound familiar. You recorded A Fork in the Road for TRRS, and it is now available in our podcast section on the Internet.
No, the other one, Blind Justice. Now, I know Wayne Wagner recorded that book. It's just, well, where have I heard that name before?
I wonder.
Bob, I thought you were interested in talking to Judge Brown.
Well, I was. I had a question that was really bothering me, but after listening to all the things he's done, he's probably too busy.
We're used to the kinds of questions that bother you, Bob. Maybe we can help.
I don't know. It's about jury trials.
What about jury trials?
It's kind of technical.
Bob, I think I can help you with that.
You know all about jury stuff?
I once served on a jury.
Gee, I didn't know that about you.
What specifically do you want to know?
Well, I was reading a story about this man that was arrested for stealing a car. And they told him that he was going to have a trial with a jury of his peers.
That's our system of justice. Juries are made up of people just like the person on trial.
That's what I wanted to ask him about. You see, that's exactly what upset this fellow. He said he sure didn't want any such going-ons like that at all.
He didn't want a jury of his peers?
No, sir. He said he didn't want to be judged by a group of car thieves.
Bob.
And to think that you were one of those peers. My, my.
Let's hope you never have to be on trial, Bob.
Why's that?
I hate to have to think where they would find any peers for you.
I think we ought to talk with Judge Brown.
Craig, welcome to Take My Arm.
Bill, I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much.
Where are you from, Craig?
I'm originally from Iowa City, Iowa. I moved to this area 35 years ago, like so many of us, to go to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill as an undergraduate. I received my BA degree in 1979 and went to law school thereafter at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
You had a very interesting turn of events as you entered law school. Tell us about that.
Well, beginning my freshman year at college, I began to suffer bizarre symptoms that frankly made no sense to the doctors at Student Health Service at Chapel Hill. And they didn't come bear full fruition until I was a first-year law student at the University of North Carolina, when my initial diagnosis was made of Behçet's syndrome, which is a very rare autoimmune disease that affects about 13,000 people in the United States. And what it is, basically, is an autoimmune disease that causes small blood vessels in the body to burst. It began initially with mouth ulcers, any type of soft mucous membrane in the body could be affected, leg and skin ulcers, ultimately uveitis, conjunctivitis, retinitis, optic nerve atrophy. Initially, my left eye hemorrhaged 19 times between 1981 and 1984. I've had 3 shots of steroids into my right eye to try and save it and prolong its life. I've ingested probably 400,000 milligrams of prednisone along the way, which, of course, caused all the side effects that prednisone does. As one of my doctors, John Merritt, said, prednisone has no side effects, only known effects. And that's entirely true. So that's how my journey began to change from the typical journey that someone takes going to law school.
So your disease resulted in the eventual total loss of sight for you?
It did. I was half blind during the second half of law school and totally blind 11 years later. Of course, that wasn't as bad as it was originally predicted. I was predicted to go blind in 1981 within a year or two. It took until 1992 for legal blindness, 1995 for functional blindness. But you know, Bill, that didn't stop me. I was determined to be a lawyer and be a good one. I've tried 3 capital cases. I helped build one of the biggest and strongest programs for substance abuse treatment in Durham and in the state of North Carolina, as well as the one of the first judges in Durham County to be drug treatment court trained to help establish the drug treatment court in Durham, as well as the Criminal Justice Resource Center in Durham County as well. So if you're blind, that's not the end of the story. You know, you have the rest of your life to lead. A blind person is more than being blind. I was the 4th judge in the state who happened to be blind, and that's the way I want to put it.
Craig, what were your the gamut of emotions that you went through?
Well, Bill, I was devastated. I mean, there's no other way to put it. It was the last thing that I expected to hear from my doctor. Not only did I have a chance of going blind, or a reality of going blind, but a certainty of going blind, I guess is a better way to put it, but also a chance that I would die from the disease as well. And that certainly is not what any 22-year-old would like to hear. So it was devastating. I was extremely angry for a very long time. Then I went into denial. Denial is one of the strongest emotions that any human has, because you're confronted with a serious change in your situation. You want things to remain the same so badly, and you want to believe that it will so badly. But reality is different, and it takes you a good while to get beyond denial toward the grieving process, toward the ultimate acceptance of your situation, and moving forward, which I consider to be the last step after you've resolved the issues that led you to that place in the first place.
Do you think that all of these stages had an impact on your work?
Not so much that. My father was very good at instilling a strong work ethic in me. I think it had more of an impact, frankly, on my personal life, in the sense that I was a little more withdrawn than maybe I'd been before. I was more careful about who to talk with about it than others. I didn't want it to get generally around, if you will. And I wasn't as emotional about it as I probably should have been. Frankly, looking back, I should have sought psychological treatment for the problems years before I did. Even after I did belatedly in 1996, it was probably 3 or 4 years before I completed that aspect, because there was so much sewage backed up. Because once you have one bit of denial, it backs up a whole lot of other issues and problems you need to deal with anyway. Because you've got this, you're facing this primary problem, and everything else has to wait. So it definitely slowed my evolvement as a person, I think. And that's why I would urge your listeners to deal with it in a forthright way. It is what it is, as my mom used to say. And you have to deal with it. You can't deny it. You have to deal with it.
Craig, who would you consider to be the most significant people in your life who helped you get through your adjustment to blindness?
My mom and dad. Certainly there were a host of mentors and friends at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Duke University who helped as well. But mom and dad were the primary people who were there and helped me through it. So they were certainly the biggest influence and the most help with all that over the years while they were alive.
Do you have siblings?
I do. My brother, Chris.
How's he accepted it? How's he been impacted by it?
My brother sort of marches to a different drummer. He is a landscape architect. He was not around. He was in school at the University of Arizona when all this transpired. You know, to be honest about it, Bill, I don't know that he and I have really ever talked about it in a meaningful way. He's had his own issues to deal with. We all do. The fact you don't bring them up doesn't mean you haven't accepted it. I certainly think he has. I know that I have, or at least I'm getting closer to that point. I don't know that you ever fully accept something as substantial as going blind, but you get closer to it.
Greg, in an earlier conversation, we talked about your having been a student at Lions World. Can you tell us about that?
Well, back in 1995, doctors decided that I had to go through my first stint in rehabilitation. I decided that I couldn't go at that time to the rehab center in Raleigh because it was simply too close to Durham, which is where my law practice was. And I knew myself well enough to know that I'd be on the phone every night with my partners or with my clients about their cases and problems. So I went to Lions World in Little Rock, Arkansas. It was fascinating. My friend Rick, we met at Lions World, was a construction worker who had gone blind in a construction accident several years before, and he recognized me as a newbie in the world of the blind, and he laughed and began showing me what he had learned to do as a blind person. He took me out into the courtyard of Lions World, there in the center of Lions World, and, for example, he introduced me to using auditory noises to establish where you are. For example, traffic noise, or the noise of an air conditioner or a heating unit, or the noise of a door opening and closing, how you could directionally position yourself by virtue of feeling the sun, whether it was on your face or on your back, using wind, since it usually came from one direction as opposed to another, to tell you where you were. The most interesting thing that he taught me was how to feel a building. Now, I had no idea as a sighted person how you felt a building. I just saw it, but I couldn't do that anymore. He taught me that as you came up to a building, the wind died down. As you got closer to a building, it stopped altogether. And in fact, there usually was a layer of inversion, if you will, as you got very close to the building, in the sense that you could literally feel the building, feel the approach to the building as you got closer to it, particularly if you focused on the sound of your cane and how it began to echo as you got close to the building itself. The other thing he taught me was how to grid, not only in terms of outside spaces, but also in terms of rooms, hallways, how to get there, stairwells, all those types of things, which I, again, had never thought about because I had never used them when I was sighted. So it was a transition from the sighted world to the blind world. And Rick in particular was extremely helpful as I began that journey, because Lions World, in many respects, represented my road back to independence.
Craig, tell us about your mobility training as you have advanced into blindness.
Well, I've had mobility training before I went to Lions World, probably started in 1993 or 1994, and it's continued after Lions World. I've had mobility training off and on just as a refresher several times since. And, of course, when I went to the rehab center most recently, like last month, and now, I've had mobility training there as well, because you can always get better at what you're doing. And there are always new techniques or the use of new techniques that maybe you hadn't focused on before.
Have you found that the different rehab instructors that you've dealt with have emphasized different things?
Absolutely. Whether it's Braille, whether it's keyboard, whether it's cooking, whether it's techniques for daily living, they've all emphasized different things, and they all have different stories in the situation. There's no question. There is a very well-rounded staff at the rehab center.
How would you compare, or can you compare, the study that you had at Lions World with the course of study that you're having now at the North Carolina Rehabilitation Center for the Blind?
The Rehabilitation Center is harder. I would certainly say that. In the sense that I don't know that I studied Braille. In fact, I'm sure I didn't study Braille at Lions World. So that is, I think, in many ways, indicates on my part a greater acceptance of blindness and willingness to further explore how different techniques in terms of communication, given that I'm blind. But that's been very difficult. So has been the keyboard class, because I had never really taken the time. I didn't have the time to focus on JAWS for Windows and all the evolution there. It's on version 13. I think I started on version 2 way back when. But I will say this. This week I sent email for the first time, and Durham County should be afraid.
Being a relatively new JAWS user myself, I understand that.
Huh.
It's exciting.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. My children and my wife were thrilled. Now, they've always gotten voicemail from me. Now I can hit them with both voicemail and email.
Yes.
I just can't wait. And I know I will only get better as I use it more and learn more. I mean, I'm sure I'll be back to the rehab center down the road.
Tell me how you got to the rehab center.
Well, I was very familiar with the Division of Services for the Blind by virtue of the O&M, Orientation and Mobility teachers I'd had over the years. Mm-hmm. They were always with the Division of Services for the Blind. Frankly, the person who probably got me here was Steve Murphy, because Steve Murphy, Nat Fullwood, and myself got together maybe 8 weeks ago to form a new nonprofit for the blind, the North Carolina Institute on Blindness, which your listeners will be hearing more about in other media. We're now in the process of forming a board. We've filed our 501c3. Corporate paperwork is being done. We're looking for seed money to get started.
Well, you just brought up the North Carolina Institute on Blindness. Where is its niche going to be?
Well, Bill, that's a good question. One of the things that we focused on as we formed this nonprofit is to form a nonprofit that dealt with issues that others were not dealing with. For example, sensitivity training for the corporate world, internships for the blind in the corporate world, pre-employment training after you come out of high school or college, ombudsman or advocacy. Of course, advocacy is being done, but not so much the ombudsman approach. Those are a number of things that we intend to try and do. In addition to that, we're also going to develop and promote new technologies for the blind, such as the new polymer brailler at NC State, which is now in the last stages of being tested, and will go into prototypes next year. And what that machine does, just so it doesn't stand out there as a word that people don't understand, is that brailers currently braille one line at a time on the computer screen. The polymer brailler will braille an entire computer screen at once. And, of course, that's 25 lines as opposed to one, which could open significant opportunities for the blind in the world of employment going forward. And it's right here at home at NC State.
That truly sounds fascinating. Anything dealing with improved employment opportunities is something that all of us should be embracing.
It's huge for the blind because the blind have a 70% unemployment rate, and only 45% of blind high school students graduate. There's a 55% dropout rate, which is twice the average for a sighted high school student. And that's not appropriate, and that's putting it lightly.
Well, Craig, based on your experience and the things that you've dealt with, do you have any words of wisdom that you can give our listeners?
Well, your listeners have to figure out their own words of wisdom. But from my experience, Bill, never give up. Never lie down. You fight every day for your life. And you do the very best you can despite your circumstances. The most difficult problem when you begin to lose your sight is the changes that it forces you to make. You're not the same anymore. You have to approach life differently because of your situation. And you have to also deal with the issues of depression. Depression is sitting on the shoulder of every blind person. It's our partner. And like it or not, you have to deal with it so you can have a better life, a higher quality of life going forward. You absolutely, positively must do that. In my own life, I'm still going through this process. Depression doesn't end. It's just a part of my life. I have a pity party one day a month, and that's the end of that. So it's an ongoing problem you'll have to deal with for the rest of your life, but you can find a way for you to deal with it going forward. You simply have to fight and work at the problem and realize that it's not your fault, but nevertheless, you are absolutely required to do your best, not only for you, but for your family, your friends, your children, your grandchildren, everyone. If you have a better life, they will have a better life too.
Thank you, Craig.
Thank you very much, Bill. Thank you for having me.
How about that as an example for someone who is blind?
He proved again that there is very little a blind person can't do if he's just given a chance.
Judge Brown mentioned in his book, A Fork in the Road, that he had to train the attorneys who appeared in his courtroom to make their presentations in such a way that he understood what they were trying to present. I wonder how that might have happened.
I think Dr. Bill might be able to help you with that.
Okay, let's ask him.
It's time for Insights with Dr. Bill.
This is Dr. Bill. Tell me, what's on your mind?
Bob was interested if you could give him an example of how a blind judge might be assisted in court so he properly understands all the evidence.
I think I might give him a very good example from another blind judge that we talked about some weeks ago. Sir John Fielding was a magistrate in the 19th century in London. Some of his experiences are chronicled in a book by Bruce Alexander entitled Blind Justice.
Wow, what a great title. Can you give us an illustration?
It's time now for the TRRS Radio Theater on the Air with Richard Dunnigan, Bob Martin, Mary Jo Gellenbeck, and a special appearance of Dr. Bill with another episode of Blind Justice. The scene opens with Dr. Bill about to give an example of how a blind judge uses the assistance of others in the court to help him reach a correct decision.
All right, now, picture yourself back in 19th century England, and you're sitting in on the proceedings of a woman accused of theft. All parties are before the judge, Sir John Fielding, and the bailiff is presenting the case.
The court is now in session. My lord, the next case is brought by one John Turley. He claims the defendant, Peg Button, attempted to steal a pocket handkerchief from him.
All right, Mr. Bailey. Mr. Turley, state your case.
Well, my lord, I was in a discussion with the defendant at about 11 o'clock this morning.
By defendant, you do mean one Peg Button?
Well, if so be her name, then yes, she be the one.
And what was the nature of your discussion?
Well, it was of a private matter, not relevant to the charges laid against her.
Continue.
Well, my lord, while we were engaged in our discussion, I suddenly felt a tug at my jacket pocket. I put my hand down to my pocket and noticed that my pocket handkerchief was missing. It was worth a guinea.
And you are sure that Peg Button took it?
When I looked down, I seen her passing it off to this young rascal partner of hers, about to take off running down the street. Worth more than a guinea it was.
Mr. Bailey, were you able to apprehend this lad?
No, my lord. From the witnesses I interviewed, the lad was nabbed by Mr. Turley here, who wrestled the handkerchief away from him. But the boy twisted away and took to his heels.
Oh, the boy got away all right. But I retrieved my pocket handkerchief. Back in my pocket it is. Maybe even two guineas.
Miss Button? Have you anything to reply?
Indeed I do, sir. Most rightly I do, sir. I was just having a morning chat with the gentleman, me being a lady and all, and suddenly this street urchin came sneaking up and eased up to the gentleman.
Mr. Turley?
That be the gentleman's name. Then yes, sir, my lord, it be him.
Go on.
Well, The scamp reached out his hand and slipped it into the gentleman's jacket pocket and then slid out his pocket handkerchief. If the gentleman felt me hand on his jacket, it was only because when I saw what the little thief was trying to do, I reached down to stop him, I did, me being a proper lady and all.
And then what?
Well, the gentleman, Mr. Turley, goes mad, flailing his arms around and snatched at the lad. Pushed me right out of the way, he did, not treating me with proper respect and all.
And you just stood there?
Oh, no, sir. What with him flailing about and screaming, thief, thief, that's not something a lady should put up with. So, I hiked up my skirts and took to me heels.
Mr. Bailey?
That's about it, my lord. The lad got away, but Mr. Turley chased down Miss Button and brought her before a constable and charged her with the theft of a pocket handkerchief.
Yeah, both over 3 guineas.
And I bought a pair of them before your lordship.
I should be recompensed for my time and the almost loss of my pocket handkerchief. Worth 9 out of 4 guineas it is.
Mr. Turley, would you hand this handkerchief to Mr. Bailey?
Here it is, Governor. Worth?
I'll determine its worth. Mr. Bailey?
I have it, my lord. It's a bit tattered, rather dirty, and obviously used several times.
My lord, it's been a bit drafty out today. Lots of soot in the air.
Something a gentleman would be proud to be seen with, Mr. Bailey?
I should hardly think so, my lord.
Still worth a guinea or two, I should think.
Anything else, Mr. Bailey?
Yes, my lord. It's embroidered with initials.
Aye. Hand-embroidered, like I said. Quality.
And what are the initials, Mr. Bailey?
F.S., my lord.
F.S. How do you explain that, Mr. John Turley?
Well, you see, your lordship, it was, a gift. Yeah, that's right, a gift. From a lady, an admirer. So, you see,
I see. She must not have been a close admirer, not to know your name. Eh, Mr. Turley?
Well, she was a brief acquaintance and must have gotten muddled about my initials. But after all, it is the sentiment that counts.
Yes, indeed, the sentiment. Well, Mr. Turley, I tell you what. The court will keep possession of this until such time as we might meet this giver of the gift and question her of her sentiments.
But it's worth at least a guinea, isn't it?
Case dismissed. Miss Button?
Yes, me lord?
Since there seemed to be no one here to accuse you, neither do I. Go and sin no more.
Thank you, my lord.
And so ends another case of Blind Justice. Does that answer your question, Bob?
About a judge understanding the evidence? Yes. But Judge Feeling didn't use a jury. If he had, would the peers had to have been pickpockets?
Why would they have to have used pickpockets?
Dr. Bill, prior to the interview with Greg Brown, Bob was concerned about the process of a jury of one's peers. Now, he was right on point with the significance of the presence of a jury, but he may have missed the point about what constitutes a peer.
You don't have to be a pickpocket or steal a car to be a peer?
Or any other kind of illegal activity.
Oh, I'm sure glad you're here, Dr. Bill. What is a peer? And why are they important for juries?
Let me explain that. I think the best understanding will come from a section of the Constitution. In Article 3, Section 2, the Constitution says, and I quote, "The trial of all crimes, except in cases of impeachment, shall be by jury. And such trials shall be held in the state where said crimes shall have been committed."
Okay. But why is that important?
Since I was one of those peers, let me explain. What it guarantees for all people is that the government can't just set up a court and accuse someone. Besides the judge, there must be a panel of ordinary citizens, just like you and me, that have to decide guilt or innocence.
They aren't car thieves?
No, and neither can they be the owners of the car that was stolen.
That's right. 12 ordinary people who know nothing of the situation. They have to be convinced that you did it before you can be punished.
Not someone in authority. 12 ordinary people. That's the guarantee of a jury by your peers. And that right dates back to the Magna Carta of 1215.
But why 12 people?
Good question. In ancient times, many numbers had significance other than just a means of counting, and 12 was one of those numbers.
There were 12 apostles and 12 tribes in ancient Judea.
And 12 hours to rock around the clock.
That too. But as far back in English history as 913, there was a legal code that recognized the norm as 12 good men and true. And by the 12th century, that principle was firmly established in English law.
But there is an even earlier tradition involving the number 12 that might be a little more surprising. Some scholars have pointed out that the system that emerged in the 12th century under English law is almost identical with the Islamic Latif.
I remember this. They talked about this on the Did You Know program once.
That's right. So just mentioning it briefly, the Latif was a body of 12 members drawn from the neighborhood and sworn to tell the truth. They were bound to give a unanimous verdict about the things that they had seen or heard regarding any situation brought before them. And that verdict was binding on the judge for the purpose of establishing the truth of any case involving ordinary citizens.
And it was the right of any plaintiff to demand this kind of process. So, just as in later English law, here is an example of 12 good men and true. What is important is that any person accused is given the maximum amount of freedom to prove their innocence. And you can't be convicted just because somebody doesn't like you.
And Judge Brown was able to make sure that happened correctly. And he could do it, even though he was blind.
Yes, he was. And remember, he had to depend on attorneys and witnesses to describe every situation so that he could understand it in order to make a decision.
It's a little like me when you asked, what makes someone attractive? What someone looks like doesn't determine attractiveness to me, and it doesn't determine guilt or innocence to the judge.
You know, in his case, blind justice means more than just the title of his book.
And the reason that we use it as a part of our programs, too.
Yes, indeed. It really is a statement of a guarantee of freedom and equal opportunity. Our little blind justice episodes keep pointing out that there are so many things that blind people can do, and do well.
If they are just given the opportunity.
Look at what Just Plain Bill has been able to accomplish, as well as so many others that we have met over the weeks.
Judge Brown has said it. Just Plain Bill has said it. And I say it. Blind people are just ordinary people who happen to be blind. Thank you for telling me what's on your mind.
And so ends another episode of Insights with Dr. Bill. Conversations. The voices of TRRS.
We have with us today Paula Passmore. Paula, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Bob. I'm glad to be here.
If we could start out, please, just tell the listeners a little about yourself.
Okay. I'm Paula Passmore. I've lived in Raleigh for close to 20 years now, and I've enjoyed volunteering here at TRRS. I'm a recent volunteer, so I haven't been doing it very long, but it's very rewarding so far. I grew up on the coast of North Carolina, and then I went to school in the mountains. So then when I graduated, I thought I'll move to Raleigh and I'll be right in the middle, equal distance to the beach and equal distance to the mountains, two places that I love. And it's been great. I moved here. My grandmother lived here. I had a sister who lived here. And one friend from college. Other than that, I didn't know anybody. Took a first job at what was CP&L a long time ago. I worked there for 3 years, and then I joined a consulting firm where I have been for the last 20 years.
What would a typical day at work have been like for you?
Oh, my. There's no day that's the same. I'm in HR, so I deal with a lot of problems. and so every day there's something new, a different challenge. And so it's always been a mystery, not knowing what's going to happen from one day to the next. I kind of like that. It gets in your blood, the unexpected.
Well, when you get away from the job and get back home again, how about any kind of hobbies?
Oh, yes. I really love soccer. I never played soccer in school, but I always said if they had had soccer when I was growing up, I would be the next Mia Hamm. I really quite like it. I play in the outdoor and the indoor. I've been on an injury reserve for about a year, but I had a back injury. But aside from that, that is my it's in my blood. I like it. So I like to play soccer. And so when I can't be that active or doing something ballistic like that, then I like to have dinner with friends and, you know, big cooking at people's houses. I'm not the great cook, but I like to learn. Well, I also enjoy singing. And, in fact, I was in the Christmas Carol here in Theater in the Park production for 6 years, quite a few years ago.
Oh, with Ira David Wood.
With Ira David Wood.
Oh.
Yeah. And before that, I was a soloist at one of the local churches, so I quite like singing. And I like voices. I like speaking in other voices, and suddenly out of nowhere I'll be talking in a British accent or some other accent. I wouldn't say that's a hobby, but it's just something that I do, something fun.
You said you're just a recent volunteer with TRS. What got you interested in us?
Well, a few years ago, I volunteered for the American Cancer Society, and I took a break from that, and I was looking for a way to give back to the community. And my work was very, very demanding, and I needed a way to absolutely make sure I have something that I'm doing meaningful outside of my day job, so to speak. So I met Missy Hollander, and the rest is history. She talked a lot about her work here and how fun it was and how meaningful it was, and she got me connected, and I'm quite happy.
Okay, in your volunteer time here, do you do a recorded show, or is it mostly live readings?
It's live readings. In fact, in Monday evenings. Every other Monday, actually, in the evening.
One other thing I'd like to ask you, is there something else that you'd like to add?
I would. In fact, I would like to ask people to call or somehow get in touch with TRRS and give feedback. How do they like the show that they're listening to? And if there's feedback for me specifically, I'd like to hear that too.
You'd like people to call in and say how much they like you every other Monday evening on USA Today.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Paul, very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you.
And Barry Tenser. Barry, thank you for being with us today.
Bob, it's my pleasure.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm glad to. It's probably one of my most favorite subjects, okay? I moved to Fearington Village, North Carolina, in 2001 from Bergen County, New Jersey. I'm a New Yorker born in Brooklyn, grew up in Brooklyn, and lived in New York all my entire life. I was a vice president of Gimbel's Department Store before I retired, so my entire life has been in retailing. During that time, I worked for Gimbel's. All I wanted to do was star on Broadway, star on television, star on radio. I never got the chance until I moved to North Carolina. At dinner one night, I met a friend of mine who also lived in Farrington Village. And after talking to him for a while, he said, you know, you'd be great. I want you to meet my friend, Linda. Came out to Triangle Radio Reading Service, spoke to Linda Ort. Within 10 minutes, I made a tape, and within 2 weeks, I was on the air. And it has been probably the happiest 10 years of my entire life.
Can you tell us about some of your best moments on the air?
Best moments of the air was when I was able to convince Linda to let me script the first 10 minutes of the show. I'm a sports nut. And what I do is going to Fridays. By the way, I host the Friday News at Noon show, which I've worked on since February, I believe, of 2002 or 2003. What I do is going through the sports section of the News and Observer, spotting the things that are important to people around here, UNC, NC State, Wake Forest, Duke, ACC, and NASCAR. And by the way, I learned, being a New Yorker, NASCAR meant absolutely nothing to me. I thought it was one race a year, the Daytona 500 and the Indianapolis 500. I was told very nicely by one of our listeners, one of our very good listeners, that you don't know what you're talking about, young man. NASCAR is big here. Since that time, I've learned about NASCAR. I read about NASCAR. In fact, today's program, beginning at 12 o'clock today, and I hope everybody listens to me at noon on every Friday, from noon to 1:30, I will be covering the beginning of the NASCAR season, which opens up in February. This particular week, to give you an example, I've covered the big NC State-UNC game last night, a couple of upsets in college basketball, and NASCAR. It's one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done, and I just hope our listeners are receiving as much information and as much joy from the broadcast as I am bringing it to them.
How did that UNC game come out last night?
UNC didn't beat NC State. UNC didn't destroy NC State. UNC annihilated NC State by one of the worst performances that NC State has had under Mark Gottfried.
You said a little earlier that you were a frustrated Broadway actor. Tell us how you fulfill that at TRRS.
It gives me an opportunity to realize that I'm in front of a microphone, and my voice could be going nationwide, worldwide, because I heard our broadcast once in Florence, Italy. Very simple, because you were on the computer. All you've got to do is go to TRRS, punch in podcasts, and you'll hear my last Friday's broadcast. And you can do it whether you're in Raleigh, whether you're in Durham, or if you're in Italy.
Do you have any other family that listens to you regularly?
What I do every noon, the first thing I do is I call my son, who lives in California, in his office. He puts it on speaker. He then calls my daughter in Rockland County, New York, conferences both. She has it on loudspeaker so that my broadcast is heard, in addition to, I hope, all over the area. Certainly in my son's office in California, my daughter's office in New York. Just being in front of a live microphone to a frustrated New Yorker is a thrill and a half, and it has been a thrill for the complete 10 years that I've been here.
It sounds like you're a real sports enthusiast. We're coming in close to the end of the football season now. Do you have a favorite team?
I've been a season ticket holder for the New York Giants since September 9th, 1960. From 1960 until I moved here in 2001, I missed a total of 6 home games. On Sunday, when the Giants beat the 49ers, after screaming and yelling like a banshee, I ran upstairs, and on my computer was a message I've been waiting for a long time. Dear Mr. Tenza, you have been selected to purchase 2 Super Bowl tickets for the game in 2 weeks. Right now, since I'm here in North Carolina, my daughter lives in New York. She will be picking up my 2 tickets tomorrow, FedExing them to me, and my son, my grandson, and I will be in the audience at the Indianapolis Stadium, Lucas Oil Stadium, on Sunday, was it February 5th. It'll be 3 generations of Tensers: my son, my 7.5-year-old grandson, and me, the old man.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. It's something I'm looking forward to, and it's going to be a great weekend, the same kind of weekend as my son took me 4 years ago to Arizona.
Barry, do you have any final thoughts today?
Yeah, my hope is that I hear just once from one of our listeners. I repeat every single week. Our phone number is 832-5138. I would love to have audience feedback. Now, remember, I'm on every Friday from noon to 1:30. It's news at noon on Friday. Please, please tune in.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Bob.
It's time again for the TRRS Radio Theater on the Air with Bill McClure, Richard Dunnigan, and Bob Martin with another episode of Blind Justice. The scene opens with Bill and Bob as police officers.
It was the 25th of November, another sleepy, dusty Delta day. Bill and I had just solved a big crime the day before, and a reporter wanted to know what we had to say.
I guess solving this case was especially gratifying, being it happened on Thanksgiving Day.
Solving a big crime is always cause for Thanksgiving.
Ooh, especially when you can make it home for dinner.
And this one was big.
Ooh, it sure was. At least a 25-pound turkey, and mashed potatoes, and yams, and sweet corn, homemade cranberry sauce, yeast rolls, and just gallons of sweet tea.
I mean the case.
Did I mention the stuffing?
You did now.
We had bread and giblet stuffing.
I think he wanted to know about the case we just solved.
Oh, that was big, too. Police all over the country knew something had been planned for Thursday, November 24th of 2011. but they didn't know what it was going to be or where it was going to happen. So they called in Bill.
You see, they had a phone transmission, but they couldn't decipher it, so they called me in.
Bill's an expert in this area, you know.
In wiretaps?
In being able to listen to them and tell you what's happening from the sounds that may be heard.
I can hear the sounds the phone makes and tell you what telephone number is being called. If I hear things like bells or trains, or sometimes just echoes, I can tell you things about location. So I listened to the transmission.
And?
And the first thing I found out was from this. Kansas.
Then what?
Ooh, I forgot the rice pudding.
I could hear a train passing through. The sound the engine made was consistent with the engines that are used on the Kansas-Oklahoma line.
So?
And as the train slowed down entering the town, I could hear the sounds of a river nearby.
Which meant?
There are several tributaries of the Arkansas River that flow through that area of the Smoky Hills. We checked railroad schedules for the times the calls were made.
Where were they?
It had to be La Crosse, Kansas.
Wow, that was quite an accomplishment.
Grandma always was a great cook.
But what were they after?
Remember, this was to take place on November 24th.
Thanksgiving Day.
And what a day it was.
But the planned robbery had nothing to do with Thanksgiving Day.
It didn't?
No, it had to do with jealousy.
Oh, lots of people were jealous of Grandma's cooking.
You see, the calls to La Crosse, Kansas had originated in Texas and Oklahoma. And there were people there that wanted something that the people in Kansas had.
And what was that?
Grandma always had a natural sense of timing. By the time she finished cooking, everything was coming off the stove and onto the table at the same time. And all the pots and kettles were already washed and in the drying rack.
We weren't certain at first, and then we heard them talk about a wire transfer.
A wire transfer?
Yeah, my Uncle Pete sent a telegram that he couldn't make it. Boy, was he sorry.
Everyone else thought they meant money to an offshore account, but I had my doubts.
I've always had doubts about Uncle Pete. He claims he's a vegetarian, and then I've seen him licking the dog dish.
What did you think it meant?
It meant the dog must have gone hungry. The dog always did look at Uncle Pete kind of funny.
I wasn't sure until I heard one fellow say, "You can split the steaks." And the other fellow replied, "Et tu, Brute?" That gave them away.
How?
The tone of the first voice I suddenly recognized as belonging to a notorious thief, always known as Brutus.
And the Et tu, Brute, the statement from the assassination of Julius Caesar.
Yes, but this time it wasn't a statement. It was a question.
He was asking Brutus a question.
I told you, people from both Oklahoma and Texas were involved, and they wanted to be sure that Brutus took two steaks.
They were stealing steaks?
Grandma never served steak for Thanksgiving. Only turkey and dressing and mashed potatoes and sweet corn and cranberry sauce and sweet rolls and gallons of sweet tea.
That's right.
But why?
We all like sweet tea.
Once I realized that it wasn't about Thanksgiving, it was simple to figure out what it was all about. November 24th, the date that barbed wire was invented, and La Crosse, Kansas, the location of the Barbed Wire Museum.
And so?
Grandma served steaks on the 4th of July.
There are also barbed wire museums in Texas and Oklahoma, which claim more barbed wire than the museum in Kansas, and the people there wanted Brutus to steal the two original steaks that were used in the original fence that was put up in DeKalb, Illinois.
And move them to Texas and Oklahoma.
Oh, Grandma would never move there. We'd have to travel too far.
Thanks to the help I was able to provide, we put a stop to the planned theft.
And how did it all end?
Like always, pumpkin pie and more sweet tea.
They caught Brutus inside the museum with his wire cutters in his hand. When the police turned the lights on, Brutus tried to run, but caught his pants on, you'll never guess.
Barbed wire.
Barbed wire. He was caught in flagrante delicto.
Which means?
With whipped cream.
Red-handed. And now he's looking at barbed wire from the inside.
Bill, your abilities are amazing. I can understand your alertness to sounds, but how did you learn so much about barbed wire?
Did you know? I listened to a lot of programming of the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
And you learned things like that from their programs?
And a lot more. There's more than just entertainment there. Their program is also a lot better than you ever might have expected.
What's on the agenda now?
Well, I've got some leftover turkey sandwiches, and I'm going on a picnic. And I've got breadcrumbs for the ducks.
You mean?
Yep. I'm going to throw them into the muddy water off the Lake Johnson Bridge. Do you want to go?
Why not? Do you know, I love good turkey sandwiches.
And how about you, Bill?
I'd love to have a turkey sandwich, but I haven't got time to go on a picnic. I have a piano to tune.
And so ends another episode of... Blind Justice.
Bill, do you think I could become a peer?
That's not something you have to train for. You are a peer. You are an ordinary citizen, and it's a right and a privilege to be one of the 12 people, good and true. And if you are called to jury duty, you are a peer.
But I know so many people who try to get off of jury duty. They even make up reasons why they can't be on a jury.
They think they are too busy or that they have more important things to do.
But just picture the off chance that you may need a jury someday. Whom would you want to sit on that jury?
People who would understand what it might have been like to be in my situation.
And if they were all too busy doing more important things?
It wouldn't be too good for me, would it?
Gives you something to think about, doesn't it?
It sure does. Do we still have time for a visit with Professor Bill?
For you, Bob, always. It's time now for Outside the Box with Professor Bill. The problem. You have 10 bags of coins. The bags are the same and there is the same number of coins in each bag. Each bag should weigh 10 pounds, but all the coins in one bag are counterfeit and so weigh 1/10 of an ounce less than the real coins. The coins feel the same and look the same. The only way you can identify the fake coins is by weight. You have an accurate digital scale. Can you find the bag of counterfeit coins with just one weighing?
Professor Bill, don't digital scales have little flashing lights that tell the weight?
So I've been told.
But you can't see them. Wasn't Outside the Box about solving problems without being able to see?
Bob, I can't see the scale, but I can hear it. Weren't you listening to the presentation about the appliance store at Governor Moorhead? There are all kinds of electronics that we can use that talk to us, like my talking calculator. Listen.
1000 times 0.1085 equals 1000.085 divided by 12 equals 90.416666.
How about that?
So I can find the fake coins in one weighing. Can you?
Yes, I can. Watch this. Listen to this. I put all the bags on the scale at the same time. If they are supposed to weigh 10 pounds each, except for the counterfeit bag, the total weight will be just under 100 pounds. Now, if I take one bag off at a time, I watch. If the weight is still under what it should be, the fake bag is still on the scale. I keep going until the weight is correct and voila, I have the counterfeit bag in my hands. One way, because the scale was never empty.
Did the scale talk to you after each bag you took off?
Well, of course. That's how I knew when I got to the counterfeit bag.
Sorry. Each time it talked to you, a separate weighing.
Oh, shucks. And it had such a nice voice.
Be sure to tell that to the scale. Actually, your idea is on the right track. Here's how you can do it with just one weighing. Line the 10 bags up in a row. Now, take one coin out of bag 1, 2 out of bag 2, 3 out of bag 3, and so on. Put all of these coins on the scale, and what do you have?
A weight less than it should be, but I don't see how that'll help.
How much less?
That makes a difference?
If each coin is a tenth of an ounce underweight, how many tenths are you under what should be?
Oh, of course! Since the same number of coins came out of each bag as the number on that bag, the number of tenths underweight will tell you which bag is a fake.
If it is 5 tenths, bag number 5, or whichever bag it happens to be.
You know, Professor Bill, there's only one problem with your solution.
And what's that?
I only get to listen to the scale once.
Another solution, thanks to creative thinking from... Outside the Box. Some final thoughts. The following are from Mark Twain.
I have a greater and grander standard of principle than George Washington. He could not tell a lie. I can, but won't.
Always do right. This will gratify some people and astonish the rest.
Don't go around saying the world owes you a living. The world owes you nothing. It was here first.
Education, that which reveals to the wise and conceals from the stupid the vast limits of their knowledge.
I have been through some terrible things in my life. Some of them actually happened.
Be careful about reading health books. You may die of a misprint.
Clothes make the man. Naked people have little or no influence on society.
Do something every day that you don't want to do. This is the golden rule for acquiring the habit of doing your duty without pain.
This is Bill McClure for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and thank you for tuning in to another edition of Take My Arm.
This is Richard Dunnigan. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is designed with the assistance of print and visually impaired volunteers.
And this is Bob Martin. If you know someone who is print or visually impaired and might enjoy listening to our programming, please have them call us to arrange for the use of a subchannel receiver. The number is 919-832-5138.
We can also be heard via the Internet by going to the TRS website and looking for the prompt that indicates podcast. You will find many of our programs that are available to listen to again.
If you could help underwrite our programming, any donation you could make would be appreciated. Again, the number is 919-832-5138.
Until next time,
goodbye.